All right, we are breaking this down into three steps. It sounds simple, right? Now, sometimes the devil's in the detail, right? And we're gonna talk about some of the details. But here are three steps that generally guide you into improving machinery safety at your facility. Now, just a word on our company. By the way, this is a technical presentation, but I do have a couple of infomercial slides here we will get out of the way. I work for a company called Machine Safety Specialists, and we are safety engineers. We provide consulting services. About half of our customers are proactive, and that's awesome, meaning they improve machine safety and machine safeguarding before an injury. Unfortunately, you know how the world works, and not everybody is proactive. And so many times we are going in after a serious injury or fatality with machinery and helping the employer to understand what is required with machine safeguarding. Sadly, often we are the people informing customers that it's no longer the 1940s and 50s. The standards have changed, the technology has changed, and it's a new day, and we need to improve our machinery safety out of, you know, some of these machines are 50 and 70 years old. Now, we are centered here in Ohio, based in Ohio, glad to help take care of Ohio companies and help out on Ohio employers. But we also do work internationally and nationally. I've been to Europe several times, the Asia Pacific region, and we go all over the country helping mid and large size companies solve their machine safeguarding problems. So we're glad to work with you no matter the size of your company. Okay. Now we will start digging into the subject of three steps to improve machinery safety at your workplace. Now, we need to set the scope of this. Actually, one of the keys to unlocking improved safety is to understand there's a difference between machines. I was presenting our material to an employer a few weeks ago, and the employer was actually kind of getting a little frazzled and a little frustrated. He said, "You mean to tell me that when I'm on the forklift, I can do all these dangerous things, but as soon as I step off the forklift, the rules change if I'm running a different machine?" I'm like, "Yep, exactly right. The rules for a forklift are different than the rules for a machine, like a lathe or CNC machining center or robot and so on. And so we need to be careful and give a little bit of attention what type of machine we're dealing with, because the safety standards are different. So what's included in this presentation is what's called fixed industrial machinery. And when we say fixed, we mean it is stationary, either bolted to the floor or somehow not on wheels. This includes laboratory equipment. It also includes robotics and machine tools. And kind of the biggest category here is automated and custom industrial machinery. So what we're teaching today applies to likely most of the mainline machinery that is doing your production in your facility. The main machine tools and machinery, including custom and automated machinery. We know that machines these days can be very large and complex. And so these standards cover all of those fixed industrial machines. What is excluded from my training today is mobile equipment. So cranes, and elevators, what we call lifting equipment, those have different standards. Mobile equipment such as forklifts, construction equipment, cranes, bulldozers, those are different. The safety standards are different. Also appliances, dishwashers, coffee makers, all that's a different standard. Portable tools and hand tools. So what we're covering today does not cover circular saws and portable, both powered and non-powered hand tools are excluded. Also fire detection and suppression systems. You know, the rules for an emergency stop button on a machine are different from the fire suppression system in your building. Also, this standard, we are going to talk about circuitry, interlock circuitry, and control reliability, but this is not primarily an electrical safety class. So we're not going to talk about shock prevention, grounding, or fire prevention. Again, those are other standards. And if you look at this from a high level, you see that some equipment relies on what's called human factors or human decision making. You know, if you're running a crane, right, or a bulldozer, you need a highly skilled people who show up to work and they're trained and ready to go, and they need to be a clear head, and it's all governed by what's called administrative measures. You know, we're guiding, there's a lot of decision making in that. However, if you're running a robot cell, it shouldn't rely on human factors, right? You shouldn't have to have a person make a lot of decisions that the robot shuts off when you enter the cell. So this dividing line is generally between machines that require human factors and machines that don't. And by the way, the machines that were designed way back in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, a lot of those maybe depended on human factors. Well, the standards have changed, and you may need to update your machinery to the latest guarding and technology, which eliminates a lot of those human factors. So that is kind of the overarching goal here, is to you put in reliable safeguarding techniques that do not depend on human factors. Now, let's get started on the material. The basic steps to improving machine safety at your facility are, first, you need to be motivated to do something. As I mentioned, there are different motivators. We'll go into that. The next step is discover what the hazards. You need to know what to do, right? Once you're motivated to do something, you need to know what to do, discover those hazards. And the third step is control the hazards. So let's go into those three steps in more detail. Step one, motivators. What are motivators? Well, we're all motivated by different things. I personally, and I would recommend this for our audience, as the primary motivator is to prevent injuries. That these days, that's called our social responsibility. In years past, it used to be called our moral and ethical obligation, right, as human beings. And that is to prevent harm and injury to human beings. And it's really the golden rule: treat others as you would like to be treated. So first and foremost, and above, overarching above any sort of law and regulation, is this moral and ethical responsibility to treat others with respect and prevent them from being injured and prevent, inflicting pain and damage to their bodies. So that's a great motivator. And to that end, let me just explain. Now, some people say these photos are disturbing. These aren't bad, in my opinion. We've got a lot worse photos. But these are photos from machine-related injuries. And, you know, we see lots of lacerations. We see burns. By the way, we didn't put in the worst photos. We didn't put in the delimmings and decapitations that happen. There's horrific injuries called degloving. You may not want to look that up on the internet, but there are all sorts of terrible injuries. These happen on average approximately 28 serious injuries per day related to machinery in the United States, right? So they happen all the time, and they should not. And this is why we need to improve machine safety. We want to fulfill our moral and ethical obligation to prevent these life-changing injuries and disabilities. The second motivator, okay, I would like to think we all want to do the right thing to protect our fellow person. Some people may not care as much as others, and because of that, we have laws, right? So what are the laws? We all know about OSHA. Let me tell you about a few, what we call catch-all OSHA regulations. OSHA 1910.212 says the machine must be designed to prevent the operator from having any part of their body in the danger zone during the operating cycle. Okay, you want to talk about a catch-all, right? According to OSHA, you may not have any part of your body in the danger zone during the operating cycle. That's pretty big. If OSHA is trying to find a way to cite you, they actually don't have to look far after you have an injury. All right. Another kind of catch-all OSHA phrase is this general duty clause. It's up front in the OSHA manual in Section 5. And it says the employer must furnish a place of employment that is free from recognized hazards. So then the question is, what's recognized? So years ago, employers and especially management used to close their eyes, bury their head in the sand and say, don't tell me. I don't want to see the report because I don't want to recognize the hazard. Well, that doesn't fly legally. And what we see in practice is this is enforced by what's called an OSHA recordable injury, a recordable incident. See, when you have an employee that has an injury more than first aid, and there's a very specific set of rules for what is an OSHA recordable, when you have that recordable, your safety person must fill out a piece of paper, right? And from that point forward, that piece of paper is documented showing where the employer did not fulfill their general duty to have a workplace free from recognized hazards, right? That recognized hazard is that piece of paper that it's a recordable injury. So that's kind of a catch-all OSHA statement. And lastly, OSHA may reference or what's called incorporate by reference U.S. national consensus standards. So OSHA may, in a settlement or by reference, pull in ANSI standards, NFPA, RI standards, and any of the other so-called national consensus standards. So they are enforced indirectly by OSHA. Now, OSHA could be proactive in this, but just in practice, I'm telling you, OSHA is very busy. They have a limited staff and resources. So in my experience, we see this practiced after there is a recordable injury. There is a crackdown that follows, and OSHA will pull in these standards as needed to enforce and create a safe workplace. All right, so we look at just a low tech, you know, this is a saw, right? This may be typical, unfortunately, of some of the equipment that we see out in the field. And we see that, okay, the belts and pulleys are exposed. That's not allowed. We see an exposed saw blade. That's not really allowed, at least not to that degree. If you look closely, there's some damaged conduit wiring hanging out. So there are certain questions that come up when determining what law applies and how much you could be penalized. And so one question is, there used to be a guard that's over that belt and pulley. Was that willfully removed? You know, did an employee willfully remove that? Well, I can't say that as a safety engineer. I'm not able to determine what's willful. That's for the legal process to determine. But if it is, we want you to kind of recognize that going into this table of OSHA penalties for 2021. Now, before 2016, these were fixed. They were like stuck in time from the 1970s. But starting with a law change in 2015 and then going into effect in 2016, OSHA fines are subject to annual price increases based upon inflation. So we're showing you here the 2021 penalties for machine-related citations. And there's, if you look in this rightmost column in the 2021 dates, there's one number that jumps out at most people. Many employers, you know, they don't like the 13K number, but they can handle that. But when you start talking about $136,000 per violation, that gets everybody's attention. And again, this is a motivator for some employers. If you're not motivated to do the right thing ethically and morally, some employers need to be motivated by the serious citations and penalties that can follow. So there's something to be aware of here if you have an employee willfully remove a guard, right? Stiff penalties. Also, what we call the repeat treadmill. So if you have a machine guarding violation or a machine safety violation, and you may have repeats, and employers can get on what we call the repeat violation treadmill, and that can be devastating from a financial point of view. All right, so that's a second motivator to do something about improving machine safety, hopefully proactively. The third motivator ends up being these costs and so on. Now, one thing that I don't have in here is what's called personal injury lawsuits. Sometimes, many times that may be handled exclusively by BWC. Other times it may not be. And so what you need to be aware of is if you have an injured employee, the OSHA fines are just the beginning. There could, what could follow would be a personal injury lawsuit and their, you know, attorney fees and so on. So what ends up happening is many times we see the final financial penalties being 10 times higher. That's right, 10 times higher than the OSHA citation penalties we just saw. All right. So those are three motivators, right? Those three motivators, we want to prevent injuries from a moral point of view. We want to comply with regulations, and then we want to avoid these disruptive penalties. Now, once we're motivated to take action, and I hope that all of our employers are motivated to take action, the next step is to discover the hazards. You know, what is it that needs addressed? Well, there's a few techniques for doing this. The first technique that we're going to discuss is what's called professional machine safeguarding audits. Now, when you do that, that's when you get expert guidance. And when I say expert, I'm talking about people who are legally certified and they have the credentials needed to determine what is safe and what is unsafe and determine what is needed to bring your machine into compliance. I do machine safeguarding audits, and this is a service our company provides. We highly recommend it because you get to the bottom line very quickly and you get black and white answers. You get very clear answers on exactly what's needed. Now, although that's great and there's a lot of upside to getting the answer, you know, your answer immediately, there is a downside, and that is it's not free, right? There is a cost to that. There is a cost to getting the best correct answers and getting your machine guarding questions answered. Now, a second method of discovering what the hazards are, it's what's called a machine risk assessment process. This is a team-based, task-based approach, and it is guided by a few specific safety standards. When you talk about doing a machine risk assessment, you're not simply shooting from the hip or, you know, it's a lot different from a toolbox talk or anything like that. What you're doing is you have a team of people, a multidisciplined team, that is following the processes described in ANSI B11.0 or ISO 12100, right? So there are a few considerations. There's an upside and a downside for this method too. The upside is you can do this yourself once your people are trained. The downside is it's very time intensive. You could end up tying up your best people in a conference room for 3 to 5 days per machine, analyzing the machine. Now, we also recommend that you get training for this. So you don't just throw the standard on the table and hope that everybody's gonna follow it. You need machine safety and machine risk assessment training, and you need the tools to do it, risk assessment spreadsheets, and there's a few risk assessment tools that you need to have, mainly software tools. And we can help get you set up for that. But once we teach you how to do it, you can take this on as an internal safety improvement process. And that's called machine risk assessments. The third method, and this is a very popular method, and I'll explain why, are called these plant walkthroughs. The reason why everybody loves this, it's basically free. I say free, you know, you got the salaries of the people doing the walkthrough. But you set up a team of people and you walk through the plant and you recognize safety hazards. I'll tell you a story just real briefly. We were doing a machines risk assessment class. We were having a hands-on exercise at a pharmaceutical company. There's some robotics and other advanced machines in the room. And I was teaching them how to do a machine risk assessment. Well, it just so happened, you know, it's a real big company and sometimes communication is not the best. They had a plant walkthrough go through at the same time. So about five people came in the room and they looked around, they saw the robotics and the advanced, CNC and servo driven equipment. And they looked and they were kind of mesmerized. They looked around and we just waited as a class for them to come through. And they looked around, they said, well, nothing to see here. Nope, let's go on to the next part of the walkthrough. When that room, they didn't know, it was kind of embarrassing. We had identified over 50 machine guarding violations and high risk items. So it's kind of like you get what you pay for. We actually, although the plant walkthroughs have some value, if your people don't have the training to know what to look for, then you may be wasting your time with that, or they may become complacent and not recognize the pretty obvious, serious hazards that you may have in your facility. All right, so that plant walkthrough. So here are three different techniques, and I've kind of talked through the pluses and minuses of each of the techniques for discovering hazards. So we want to teach you, you know, what are these hazards? Well, there's impact hazard. OSHA calls that struck by. You can be crushed by machinery, either shear and crush points. Now, most normal people don't want to think about what happens if you put your hands in a scissors lift, or if a person is, their body is in a scissors lift. But I'm here to tell you, we see lots of bloody photos every week come in from the field, usually surrounded with lots of legal action. You want to avoid these. So we're learning to recognize hazards. There's what's called in-running nip points. In-running nip points. These are really, really bad because not only do they crush and typically amputate when they crush, but they pull you into the machine worse, right? And they keep on crushing. We've been involved in several, many of these after the fact, where a person's hand, arm, all the way up to their shoulder is pulled in and amputated in the process. We have, unfortunately, customers have contacted us after the fact where a person's full body has been pulled through rollers like this. So it's simply horrific. I hate to talk about it, but this is a safety webinar, so I'm gonna, you know, share this with you. It's where a person's body goes in one side and red goo comes out the other side. It's simply terrible. You may say, oh, this is crazy, why do we do? Well, then we go even in Ohio employers and we see hundreds of these exposed rollers that are driven by, you know, gear reducers and high horsepower motors. And I'm telling you, it can't happen. And it does happen. And we want to be proactive on this. So more examples of in-running nip points are belts and pulleys, chains and sprockets. Yeah, these need to be fully guarded. We will talk about that a little more. And then rotating nip points, either you could call these snag points or cutting hazards. When you think about shafts spinning, now, it really doesn't matter the speed of the shaft. It can present a hazard even at low speed. But many of these are driven by electric motors that are running, you know, 1,800 RPM. If you think about what would happen if you put your finger in these snag points on rotating shafts, they're simply horrific. Again, even low speeds are a problem. And then projectile motion, you know, if you have fragments or nail guns. We have one customer who puts air nailers on their robots. It's an amazing process. It's fascinating. It's also extremely dangerous. So when you look back at this machine, you may look at it a little bit different now after you know the OSHA citations and penalties and what the hazards are. But yeah, I mean, there are electrical hazards. There are these in-running nip hazards. And there's exposed blades. These all these things, if a person gets endangered and injured by this, OSHA is going to do an investigation and they're going to try to determine were the guards willfully removed? Did they accidentally fall off? Is this maybe your second or higher, you know, second or subsequent machine guarding violation? Now, the last machine is fairly simple, right? A saw, we can talk about that. But let's face it, it's no longer the 1950s. A lot of our plants have more advanced machinery. So how do you guard robotics and CNC and servo-driven machinery? Well, this is where it really gets interesting from an engineering point of view, where it requires technology and what's called functional safety. This new area of functional safety is needed to be able to protect workers in this type of highly automated and highly high-speed, high-energy environment. So I guess just wrapping up on how you discover these hazards, we showed you these pictures of what are the typical hazards. And these hazards are there, whether the machine is, you know, older and low technology or whether it's higher tech machinery. We see that there are three excellent ways to discover the hazards. And that is, you know, professional machine safeguarding audits, a task-based risk assessment process, or plant walkthroughs. Now, once we're motivated to take action, and once we are, once we know and we decide the processes we want to use to discover the hazards, now we have to decide what to do about it. So let me explain to you what is the framework for modern machine safeguarding in controlling these hazards. NIOSH, which is a division of the U.S. Department of Labor, published what's called a hierarchy of controls. And this establishes the priority and the sequence of applying risk reduction to fixed industrial machines. And it says the plan A, the first thing you want to do, what I call plan A, is eliminate the hazard if possible. So you want to, this is typically done in the machine design process. You want to have your engineers trained so that they can design the machine without pinch points where possible, without shear points. And yes, it is possible. It could be a matter of if you have, you know, shear point are two surfaces that slide closely together. In the machine design process, if you can separate those by at least 4.72 inches, then it doesn't create a shear point anymore because your hand can pass through these moving parts. So there's some really clever things you can do in the machine design process to totally eliminate the hazards. Now, if you're not designing machines, we've seen where the machines such as shears, right? You have a steel shear or metal shear. We've seen that replaced with like a plasma cutter. Well, you can say, well, Ken, you just changed from one hazard to the other. Yeah, but you changed from a shearing hazard that could shear off somebody's entire hand to a burn hazard, which is probably not likely to result in an amputation, full amputation, or double amputation. So you can change the technology used in your machinery to a less dangerous type of technology. And that's what's called substitution, when you substitute one type of technology for different. But the whole idea here is that rather than guarding a hazard, your plan A should be eliminating that hazard or eliminating it by substituting it with a different type of hazard. Okay, that makes sense, right? If you've got a shear, I'm just going to pick on shears today. It could be a mechanical power press or other dangerous machines. You may say, well, why do we even have this machine here? Can we just simply scrap the machine and do it a different way? Yes, that is the primary goal in machine safety, is to avoid needing to safeguard it if you can eliminate it. Moving down the hierarchy of controls, and this is plan B. And this is what you would do second if you can't eliminate it. That is, you add engineering controls. Engineering controls are things like barrier guards, safety devices, light curtains, area scanners, any of these nifty high-tech devices that either cover up the hazard or they shut off the hazard when a person gets close to the machine, right? Those are called engineering controls. So I joke around with some of our customers and my family saying, yep, my entire career is spent doing plan B, right? If you can't eliminate the machine or eliminate the hazard, then you apply engineering controls to that. Now, plan C in the hierarchy are administrative measures. These are what's called human factors. When we apply administrative measures, we're trying to change the way that people work. We're trying to put in procedures. We're trying to post signs, add PPE and things like that. And I'm here to tell you that this is the least effective way of controlling hazards. There have been studies done on this. And that is when you put in procedures and you put yellow lines on the floor and post signs. And the studies say that 70 to 80% of the time, those procedures are not followed. They're either not followed exactly or they're not followed partially, right? So this is why NIOSH shows us that administrative measures are the least effective safety measures. You can train a person until you're blue in the face. You can tell them over and over, don't touch something. But about 70 to 80% of the time, that is ineffective. People are not going to follow procedures. People are not going to follow the yellow lines on the floor. So although you need to have these procedures in place, I realize that I'm not going to say you're wasting your time, but realize that when you put in place procedures and signs, It is the least effective way to protect people. Now, there's a lot of theory on this. So there's actually this whole area of what's called functional safety and control reliability that has been developed in the last 20 years. And there's risk assessment methodology. So there's a lot of theory here. And I'm going to summarize it for you by saying the level of risk reduction must be proportional to or in line with the level of risk. So if you have a machine that's capable of a fatality hazard, you need to have a very high level of safeguarding, extremely high. You need to be built like Fort Knox, right? But if you've got a low level of risk, then you can use a low level of safeguarding. So when you think about your copier machine, right, it presents a low level of risk, you know, minor scrapes, minor burns, you know, minor pinch points. Well, you know, the guarding on a copier machine does not need to be all that great. It can be flimsy plastic. It can be simple switches, electrical devices that cost 50 cents. So compare that with a robotic cell, right? I don't know, hopefully none of us have been hit with a baseball bat, right? But that's what they tell me it's like if you're in a robot cell and the robot's moving. It's serious injury or fatality is possible. So your high power, high energy, high speed machines that are capable of D-limmings, blindness, fatality, those need to be guarded at a very high level. And we're gonna talk about what we mean by guarding at a high level as we dig into this. Okay, excuse me. So the hierarchy of controls is used to determine the order and sequence of reducing risk. And as we talked about, the number one way is through elimination techniques. But if you can't eliminate the hazards, you need to control those with engineering methods. So let's dig into a little bit more these engineering controls, since this is kind of the hot topic and a very effective way of reducing risk in your facility. This is all called engineering controls. One part of engineering controls is mechanical guarding, right? That was what was known way back in the 1950s and 60s, but it wasn't real exact back then. So what are mechanical guards in terms of engineering controls? Well, mechanical guards need to comply with the requirements in your region. Now our region, although that's Ohio, is more broadly in the US. The standards that govern mechanical guards are, of course, OSHA. You may get yourself set up for disappointment if you look to OSHA for guidance on machine guarding, since it's so out of date. So the modern standards that cover machine safeguarding are the ANSI B11 standards. So I would direct you to ANSI B11.19, also ANSI B11.0. And there are other standards that may be more specific to your machine. And if your machine is located outside the US, then we would direct you to ISO standards, including ISO 13857. Now, when people take our machine safeguarding class, they're often surprised. The comment that we hear most often is when we start the class, they say, our students will say, machine guarding, you know, it's frustrating because it's a gray area. What's guarded well for one person may not be guarded well for another. Who's to say what is an adequate machine guard? Well, I'm here to tell you today that is no longer the 1970s, and there are very specific measurements for machine guards that are required these days. When you check machine guarding, it's not a matter of can you reach it? It is a matter of what is the measurement of the guard? Does it fully enclose? What are the gaps in the guard? And there is a black and white answer of, is your machine guard adequate, yes or no? In the 1970s, there was no black and white answer, but in year 2021, there are very specific measurements that need to be followed. Also, machine guards must be what's called tamper resistant. Tamper resistant, this means that you need to have certain types of fasteners. So, the old wing nut, we're going to hold the guards on with wing nuts. That's no longer allowed. That hasn't been allowed for over 20 years in machine safeguarding. You need to have tamper resistant fasteners. Also, there's a concept of exclusive control. And that is when person one is reaching their hand in the machine, person two cannot start it up on them. That's the idea of person of exclusive control. When person one enters, either with their finger, hand, bot, or full body, nobody else can start up the machine. Having proper barrier guarding helps to enforce exclusive control. And that's something that OSHA often looks for, unfortunately, typically after a serious injury or fatality. And if you're not sure what your measurements should be for your machine guarding, whether it's a pass or a fail, this is where you can contact a machine safety engineer who can inspect it and tell you exactly what your guarding needs to cover. Now, the last slide was on mechanical guarding. Now we're switching over to the electrical side. Now this is not electrical safety. This is what's called functional safety. It's your interlocks. Does your machine have a proper interlock switch? Are your light curtains set up right? Is your safety software correct? So I'd like to explain this by saying gone are the days of a simple refrigerator switch or limit switch to ensure if your guarding is adequate. Those simple devices like Square D or Allen Bradley limit switch on a guard, or cheapo switches like these micro switches, like that turn off and on the light on your refrigerator door, you know, that turn off the light in your refrigerator, gone are those days. These days we need to have certified safety devices. If you're trying to protect a worker, you're not going to use the $1 switch or a cheapo limit switch or a switch that's easily bypassed. You're going to need a certified functional safety switch. Yes, I'm saying certified. There's a difference between general purpose devices, which are not suitable for safety, and what's called safety rated devices or functionally safety certified devices. And when you're using an electrical device to protect a human, it may not be general purpose. You're going to have to actually spend a little bit more money to get a proper safety switch. Now, this slide explains that the switch alone is not adequate. If you just wire in, and we see this a lot in the field, especially after a serious injury, they're like, oh, we need to get one of those red colored switches and wire it in. Well, I'm here to tell you that is not enough, that you get a red colored switch and just wire it in. The entire circuit, what's called the stopping function, must be what's called control reliable, control reliable. It's not simply enough that when you open a guard, the machine stops. I mean, that's good, but the world has become more complex. It's no longer the 1970s. You have to have a redundant circuit with no single point of failure, right? This is not simply two wires that turn off your machine. This is full redundancy in your wiring, and your safety switch or light curtains must be what's wired to what's called a safety relay. This is not a simple ice cube relay. This is a functional safety device that has high reliability and is fully redundant. And then you must switch off your hazardous energy with what's called redundant final switching elements. This is no longer just shutting off your motor starter, right? If you know, if you're familiar with electrical components, this is, you've got two motor starters and they're probably not old NEMA starters. They're probably red colored, because they're highly reliable and certified for safety. Now, this gets back to the idea that if you have a low risk level machine, you have a very simple inexpensive circuit, like your safety circuit on your, I'll go back to your copier machine or your laser printer, right? But if you have a machine that's capable of ripping off someone's arm or, you know, fatality, serious injury, you've got to invest some money so that you have a proper safety system with no single points of failure, with redundancy and proper devices. All right, so let's further explain this. When you conduct a risk assessment for each stopping function on the machine, you will arrive at a risk level, low, medium, or high. That tells you the level of redundancy of your circuitry. So on the left is a decision-making matrix for your machine risk assessment. And on the right is an example of what's called a safety relay, right? So your interlocks, it's not enough that they simply work. They need to have a certain reliability statistic. Yeah, I'm talking about mathematics and statistics. This is where it becomes an engineering function to determine what is your mean time to failure of the stopping function, right? And what are your reliability, what's your reliability data? Just like you wouldn't want to fly in an airplane that has multiple single points of failure, so it is, you don't want people operating machinery that in the event of a failure, it could cause a serious injury or fatality. By the way, this hasn't been allowed in the United States since 1996. This is when the modern safety, ANSI safety standards started coming in place. And unfortunately, you can still buy a machine in this country that doesn't comply. And if you, you can buy a machine that doesn't comply, install it in your shop, have a serious injury or fatality, and then you as the employer are on the hook and accountable to OSHA. All right, this is why we teach these, bringing you up to speed on the latest safety standards. So we talked about the hierarchy of controls. Last and least are what's called administrative measures. We're gonna talk about those and then we're gonna wrap up today's training. All right, administrative controls. Why do people even use administrative controls? They're 70 to 80% ineffective. why do you even use procedures and signs? I'll tell you why we use them. It's because they're cheap, right? You can type up a half sheet of paper, you can buy a sign on Granger or any other sources, and you can post it on your machine. And you may think, if you're untrained, we posted a sign that says, don't touch. Well, look at the machinery that you have out here. You know, this photo shown on this slide. Do you think posting a sign that says, don't touch, is going to be effective when they really have to reach in there to do their job? No, procedures are not effective the vast majority of the time. And you may find out that you may think you posted a procedure, they just need to post the procedure, they just need to follow it. Well, if your employee has a serious injury or fatality, you're going to find out real quickly that the procedure wasn't adequate. Rather than using procedures and signs, which have their place, you need to be using engineering controls instead. You know, move up higher in that hierarchy of controls. So what's wrong with procedures? Why am I hating on these so much? Because they depend on human factors. The modern safety standards that say that procedures and signs are simply inadequate for reducing risk on high-risk machinery, medium and high-risk machinery. So although you need to have in place, you do need to have in place work procedures, training and supervision, that if you have an injury in your workplace, we're going to find out that that is simply not adequate. And that's after the fact. And your company is going to be in a bunch of trouble with OSHA if you have a serious injury or fatality and you were relying on administrative controls as your risk reduction measures. So the whole takeaway here is you're kidding yourself if you think procedures are going to get you where you need to be. From a machinery safety point of view, you really need to have a modern, installed modern machine engineering controls. All right, so just as a summary, the process we've outlined is you need to be motivated to take action. We showed the motivators is an ethical and moral responsibility. We also, if that's not enough, there are regulations. The ANSI regulations are very advanced these days. And also for those who don't comply, there are some very serious penalties, including the repeat treadmill that you can get on. Hopefully that motivates us. Once you're motivated, you need to discover what those hazards are. We talked about the best way to go is professional machine safeguarding audits. However, those cost money. So you may want to have an internal process once your people are trained and equipped with the right tools to do machine risk assessments. And lastly, and I would say also leastly, are these plant walkthroughs, which are often ineffective in recognizing risk, especially on advanced machinery that needs special training. And then the third step in improving machinery safety is actually doing something about it, controlling the hazards. And that's where you apply the hierarchy of controls and where the number one goal is to eliminate the hazard. We'd all like to have machines that don't have any hazards. That's simply not feasible. So if you can't eliminate the hazards, then you want to apply machine guarding. That can be traditional barrier guarding that needs to meet very specific measurement requirements. There's also this whole world of functional safety and control reliability. That is, if you use technology to protect a human, then the circuits must be fully redundant. They must be monitored for failure using a safety relay or safety controller, and that may be software driven. And you must use what's called final energy switching elements with no single point of failure to control the hazardous energy. All that is under the umbrella of control reliability and functional safety. Lastly, if you think you can just post a sign and write a procedure, I'm sorry, but you're just kidding yourself. Those are ineffective 70 to 80% of the time in preventing machine-related injuries, right? So this is the process and tips and pitfalls and different methods that you may use to improve machine safety at your facility. Now, with that summary and that kind of bringing you up to speed on what the latest machine safety standards require, with that, I would like to open it up and ask if there are any questions. Now, I would also ask that I'm not often able to read the chat, so I would look to Paul or others. If the question's coming in with chat, if you could help me by recognizing those, I'd like to be able to answer those.
Sure. Yeah, I don't see any right now. So yeah, if you've got or anybody's got any questions or if you want to just unmute and if it's easier to discuss it. So
if there are. Yeah, thank you very much. If you have any questions, just unmute and shout them out, and I'll be glad to do a few minutes of Q&A.
And also, we are recording this, so we will have this. Betty will put this up on the Greater Hamilton Safety Council webpage here in the future. So if you missed it or want to go back and redo it, okay, here we got a question. What are your thoughts on photo eyes for machine guarding?
Yeah, okay. Great question on photo eyes. So I've taught you how to categorize this. So I'm going to tell you the answer. I also want to teach you how to fish, so to speak. When I hear the word photo eye, I know where that goes in the hierarchy of controls, right? It's not elimination. It's right in the middle. It's engineering control. So a photo eye is a type of engineering control. More exactly, we call that a single beam safety device. So the first thing when you're looking at an engineering control is you need to decide, is it general purpose or safety rated? There's a lot of low cost photo eyes out there, like on your garage door opener, you know, simple single beam. There's a difference between general purpose and safety rated. As I've just taught you, you need to have a safety rated photo eye. Those are more appropriately called a single beam device. If you're using a single beam device to control a machine related hazard on a fixed industrial machine, there are a few rules for using that. Let me kind of go through these and you can kind of see how these rules apply to other types of devices too. First rule is you must not be able to reach over, around, under, or through that to access the hazard. That's generally called the OTTO principle. It's an acronym. But if you've got a photo eye and it needs to be safety rated, it needs to be part of a control reliable circuit. So that's fully redundant wiring all the way out to final, your final energy switching elements are redundant. So that's special wiring. And you must not be able to reach around it. So a photo eye that you can reach under, reach over, is really not doing any good at all. So a lot of times people like single beam devices because they're cheap.